Hey everybody, welcome to episode 118 of the Go Get Outside podcast. This is your host, Jason Milligan. Welcome back, welcome aboard. Some of you may recognize today's guest from his adventure travel YouTube channel. We are speaking with the infamous Jesse St. Louis. He is probably most well known for videos about natural water slides and leaping off of tall objects into bodies of water. But in addition to all of those things, he is a professional actor, a canyoneer, a coasteering enthusiast. I'm not sure if you call that a coasteerer or if there even is a term for that at this point. He's a climber. He's a world traveler. He traveled across New Zealand for 2 years living out of a van. And in general, he is one of those people that chases adventure and exploration across the globe. And he and I got together back in February at a place in Zuma Canyon in Malibu that is pretty special to him. And we had a really frank discussion about his past, his pursuit of his acting career, and how his life changed after a very particular event in the place where we held that interview. This is one of those classic Go podcast episodes where we have a really honest discussion about our experiences in nature and how they've changed our life and the decisions we've made and how we've course corrected along the way. So with that, come with me to Malibu to talk with Jesse St. Louis about all of those topics I mentioned, a bunch of other ones I didn't even bring up, and of course, the power of Wilson Phillips.
I'm Jesse St. Louis. I'm an adventure traveler. Currently, I am working as a handyman and palm tree farmer in Florida, which I ended up doing after my wife and I lived in New Zealand in a van for 26 months during COVID. Before that, I was pursuing an acting career in Southern California, really had some life-changing experiences in the outdoors, which led me to pursue a completely different direction in my life.
Yeah, so you and I, we're going to have quite a timeline to jump across, because just the little bit we've been talking about today, I can tell that there have been a number of like transitional moments in your life. I guess the best place to start is the usual place, which is let's talk about how you grew up, where you grew up, and then kind of your path that got you to the outdoors, however long that story needs to be.
So I was born in San Francisco. We moved to New York when I was 4. One of my earliest memories, I had to be 5 or 6, was in the ocean on Long Island and just getting picked up off the ground by the swell in the ocean. And I'll never forget the feeling of the butterflies in my stomach, like almost like riding a roller coaster or something, just getting lifted up by the power of the ocean as a small kid. And it sort of kicked off a love affair with the ocean and kind of a confidence in the ocean. There wasn't mountains on Long Island where I grew up. There was a lot of sandy beaches. So you grew up boogie boarding, body surfing, and always feeling comfortable in the chaos of the waves, hitting that spin cycle, getting pounded. Like it was never something that I was scared of. The confidence grew. One time when I was 11, we went to Trinidad and the waves out there were just massive. And I was just out there in these massive waves, like getting sucked out in like runouts and riptides. And my parents were both really good swimmers. Dad had been an ocean lifeguard and my mom was on the swim team and stuff. So they had instilled like the love of swimming and I had the skills. And I remember one time I was way out there and my dad came out and said, you know, your mom's worried about you. Are you okay? And I'm like, yeah, I'm great. I'm just out here body surfing. He's like, okay, well, just, you know, make sure you can body surf one in when you're done, you know?
Dude, what nice parents. This was my experience. And I think most people, you'd go out and then you'd come in and your parents would say, stop going so far out. We can't see you there. and then you just keep riding that line.
It was great to get like that vote of confidence that they were like, oh, well, he seems like, I mean, he's not drowning. He's not panicking. But there was, like, the deepest I ever got thrown underwater in the ocean was on that trip by a massive wave. That was one where, as I'm swimming up, like, am I going to run out of breath, like, before I make it to the top? Like, that, I had that feeling. But once I did, I was like, okay, I'm still okay, you know? And those early experiences helped translate to later experiences in whitewater and stuff like that, where, I don't know, I just never really had a fear of rough water or tumultuous water or anything like that. But in terms of mountains, I never had that experience aside from, like, one camping trip in the Adirondacks when I was 14. You know, that was really my only, one of few mountain experiences I had. And that was another pivotal moment I was reflecting on recently, actually. They let me just go off. There was a waterfall. I had never seen a waterfall in person. And there was, like, maybe like a 2.5 mile waterfall hike. And they were just like, okay, off you go. I was like, I want to do this. And they let me go with my little canteen and my paper map. And I went, I finally was able to track down the waterfall years later. It's called Indian Falls in the Adirondacks, kind of on the way to Mount Marcy, which I believe is the highest point in New York State. I reached the top of the waterfall. And at the time, as a 14-year-old kid, you know, no perception of size. It looked massive from the top, you know, maybe it was 100 feet or something, is what I thought at the time. I leaned over the edge with all my weight on my walking stick and totally slid over the waterfall. I had enough time to think, I'm going to die. Like, literally felt like I'm going to die. Redlined adrenaline and, like, didn't know what to expect. And out of nowhere, I landed on my feet on a ledge that I hadn't seen from the top. Just landed on a ledge at the base of the falls. And, like, cheese grated all the way down and landed on my feet on a ledge. I'm like, I didn't die. Like, I didn't know how to process it. I was, like, in shock, redlined adrenaline. Like, a near-death experience, you could say. I mean, looking back on it now, I realized the falls is only, like, 25 feet or something like that. But at the time,
I mean, even 25 feet, there's probably rocks at the bottom. There are twigs and possibly logs and a number of things that can impale you or really damage you, even 25 feet.
Exactly. And so I had never really thought about, as an adult, my obsession with natural water slides, but I think that is the origin story.
That's hilarious because you are known now as, like, a water slide guy, natural water slide guy, and your introduction is by accident.
Exactly. It took me, like, several years of reflection to realize that must be the catalyst for that. Literally the day before that incident, I had gone on another hike to, like, a brook with, like, maybe like a 5-foot cascade drop and just sitting there eating a snack thinking, you know, wouldn't it be cool if there were waterfalls you could, like, ride, like a water slide? And then just dismissing that as, like, that's probably impossible, you know? And then the next day having that experience.
Totally by accident, you almost kill yourself and you realize, oh, you really can ride waterfalls as water slides.
Yeah, but it still actually didn't even occur to me in that moment. I thought this was just a near-death experience, not something to be duplicated, a once-in-a-lifetime thing.
Right, right.
And it wasn't until years later, my wife and I were looking for a place to get married. When we first started dating, my wife offhandedly said something like, I want to get married in the rainforest next to a waterfall. And then me, being a wise ass, said, you know, yeah, and then we can jump off the waterfall, you know, as part of the wedding ceremony or something. And so years later, like 4 years later when we were engaged, I had totally forgotten that conversation. My wife goes, hey, so are we still getting married and jumping off a waterfall in the rainforest? And I'm like, yeah, sure, I guess so. Neither one of us had ever cliff jumped, had ever done anything like that. And so that started, as an adult, that started traveling, looking for places to get married in the rainforest next to a waterfall that we could jump off of. And that led us to trips to Puerto Rico and then Costa Rica. And we ultimately ended up getting married in Puerto Rico.
When you said get married next to a waterfall, jump off of it, I immediately assumed, oh, they must have gotten married in Costa Rica.
It was a close second, but the one in Puerto Rico had an easier trail to get to for our parents and older family members. And they had a natural water slide. My wife said when she found this spot, she said, oh, there's a natural water slide too. And I'm like, what is that? And then I had remembered that thought when I was younger and then found this place that had this slide. So that was the first slide I ever did when I was, I don't know, at that point, that was maybe 2009. So 32, first cliff jump, first natural water slide. And to get there, the first time we went, it was kind of like this. It was class 2 canyoning, boulder hopping, scrambling up the creek. The easier trail to get there crossed private property. And so we weren't in contact with the landowner at the time. For the wedding, we ended up getting in contact with the landowner so we could go across the trail and our older family members could get there. And this beautiful place in Puerto Rico called Las Tenejas. And now they run guided trips there, which is great. The local people can, you know, make some extra money. It just sucks that this previous tranquil spot that we got married at, it still remains a real special place in our hearts. But we had started down this path of exploring canyons and jumps and slides years before I ever got introduced to technical canyoneering.
And at this point, are you still in New York when you get married, or have you moved out to LA at this point?
I met my wife in Florida. I lived in Florida for 9 years previous to moving to LA.
And what brought you down to Florida?
Kind of a long story. I was in New York City after college pursuing an acting career, and did some way off Broadway plays, did a couple crappy indie movies, and then lost my job waiting tables. I was working at kind of like a fancy French bistro thing, and lost my job, and then it was hard to find another one. And so my mom had moved to Florida a few years earlier, and I kind of came down just to get back on my feet for maybe a couple months or something, and then met my wife down in Florida. She grew up there. She was a reason to stay in Florida. My acting career kind of took off in Florida because at the time they had a tax credit. And so a lot of productions were happening there. They were shooting like 5 or 6 TV shows. A lot of film and stuff was going on. And so I got my SAG card in Florida after being on a show, one episode of this crappy show called Burn Notice on USA Network. Got my Actors Equity, which is the theatrical acting union down there at the Florida Repertory Theater. And so I was kind of building momentum with acting there. But I was getting older. I was getting into my late 30s. We're like looking at houses, maybe to buy a house in Florida. And we had done the traveling for the wedding. Hadn't done much else outdoors besides that. And then I was thinking, you know, maybe instead of buying a house here, maybe we should go to LA. Maybe there's more opportunity. I'll be getting more auditions. I won't have to drive 3 hours to Orlando for an audition. At least I'll be auditioning more.
And you won't even have to worry about the buying a house thing because that'll just be impossible at that point. So you can just focus your energy elsewhere.
Exactly. Exactly. And so it was kind of I call it the grand bargain, because my wife originally didn't want to move to LA. But she said, okay, I'll tell you what, I want to travel for 4 months. So let's save up a bunch of money or as much as we can. And in the next, whatever it was, year and a half, 2 years, and let's travel. And I want to go, you know, trek in the Himalayas. And we ended up traveling for 4 months. She's like, if we travel for 4 months, I'll move to LA. We'll give it a shot. So we traveled to India, Nepal, Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, and Singapore. Really, aside from Costa Rica and a few islands in the Caribbean, my first and her first extensive international traveling. India was the first place we landed. And it was just such an intense experience. You know, it was like baptism by fire. Of course, in retrospect, at the time, I didn't appreciate what I had, because my whole mentality was, I got to get to LA. I'm getting older. I'm running out of time type of thing. I had just shot this lead role in an action comedy feature that I thought was going to like, oh, that's going to be my tick, you know, and it never went anywhere. But at the time it was still in post and I thought it was going to open some doors for me. My mentality when we're at the Taj Mahal, when we're trekking in the Himalayas, was just not a place of where it would be now, which would be a place of gratitude and in the present moment. It was more of a place like, we got to hurry up. This is nice, but let's go. And so it was a totally different mentality. In a lot of ways, I kind of ruined that experience. Not the entire 4 months, but much of it I ruined for my wife, because I was so negative and so, I don't want to be here. I want to get there. And she had wanted to extend the trip too. She was like, oh, this is great. Let's just keep going. And I was like, no, we got to get to LA. We got to get to LA. And it was just such a stupid mentality looking back on it. When we finally got here, after a while, I realized, oh, you were right. We should have stayed traveling. At the time, it was a bad thing because it certainly put a strain on our relationship. And just after I got to LA and it wasn't what I had thought. I didn't realize that the industry was totally different. The entire mid-budget movies were totally gone now. And all the movie stars that had been acting in the mid-budget movies were now doing TV. And so they were taking roles from like the up-and-coming actors. And so just the studios were collapsing and Netflix was taking over. And
yeah, you came at the time when so much of production had moved to other places. When I moved out here in 2002, similar thing. I originally came chasing animation, and I came right at the time that 2D animation was dying across the world. And you came right at the time that the kind of work you wanted had moved to other places like Florida.
And then Atlanta, really. started popping off. Because once the tax credit ran out in Florida, they didn't renew it, and then Atlanta just blew up, you know, all the Marvel stuff. And
it was so weird to me. I left Baton Rouge in 2002 because there's nothing there even remotely related to the entertainment industry.
Yep.
And then years later, I had friends who were working on big budget movies, and there was nothing out here for me.
And so that led to definitely a midlife crisis once I got out here, because I realized that there were a lot of levels to it, but what it boiled down to was I was pursuing this acting career in many ways because for so long, like friends, family, people had said, you know, it's tough to make a living doing that. It's going to be hard, or we don't think that's the right path, or I wanted to prove other people wrong. It was more out of a desire to prove others wrong.
So like a stubbornness.
Exactly.
Like, I want to show that I can do the impossible
exactly.
thing.
Exactly. Exactly. And so it was not bringing me joy. Like, my wife would say to me, like, I'd have an audition and I'd be like working on the lines and I would just be so angry. And she would say, you know, this doesn't seem to be bringing you any joy. And she was right, because I wasn't doing it. Like, it may have started from a place of love and passion, which I think for most people it does. But for me, it had turned into kind of a burden of like, that is how I defined myself for so long that I didn't know how to define myself any other way.
Right. And then the problem you run into is you define yourself based on a thing that's not completely up to you, how it turns out. So your self-worth is wrapped up in circumstance that you can't fully control. Either you're going to get super lucky and you're going to get a huge break and then you're going to feel like you're the greatest person on earth, or every little disappointment is going to chip away at your self-worth.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so through a combination of things, one of which being I knew a producer out here. She was a friend that I had met at this summer camp in Maine that I had gone to from middle school to high school. Every summer I would go for a month to this summer camp up in Maine. And actually that was another sort of planting the seed of outdoors in me, because they had a ropes course. And so I got really good at the ropes course. I did the whole thing blindfolded and eventually learned how to belay like my final year there. And my last year there, they like bolted a rock face they had and learned a little bit of climbing, learned how to rappel. But that was when I was younger, but it had planted that seed of the outdoors in me. She had moved to LA several years earlier, and she said, like, you know, as an actor, if you're in LA, like, you have to have a YouTube channel now. And I was like, well, I don't know. What am I going to do on YouTube? You know, I didn't know. She's like, you have to compete like in the market now. You have to have a YouTube channel. You have to be on social media. And I wasn't even on Facebook until 2014. So I was like so far from social media. It wasn't even on my radar, you know. I started out just kind of doing random stuff. Like if we went on a hike, I would like film the hike. Or sometimes I didn't know what a vlog was. You know, I learned how to edit on a linear editing system at my public access TV station back in high school.
Yeah,
and,
same.
And like shooting horror movies in middle school on like VHS cameras and like eventually like a 8mm cassette like video camera. And I wanted to be a filmmaker when I was like younger. And then eventually I got on the lighting crew in high school and saw a production of like Grease or something. I was like, I could do a better job than they're doing, you know? So that led me to want to act. Like, I had not edited or shot anything since I was 13 on like 8mm tape.
Things had changed a bit.
Exactly. So like, I didn't know anything about rolling shutter, video compression, editing, you know, stabilization, you know, how like shaky video will like make viewer motion sick or anything like that. I was just shooting on my camera, shooting on an old waterproof Nikon Coolpix with like a scratched lens. So everything was like cloudy. It was terrible. Like, my early videos on YouTube were just so bad. But I was like, she said I need to make YouTube videos. So I started and...
And you're saying this is around 2014, 2015, something like that?
This was, I think... So I started editing some stuff from the trip that we took. Like, I had a ton of old footage from that, the four-month trip. So I started... But my first vlog was like 2016, going to Death Valley. It was terrible. I was just throwing stuff against the wall. And like, I had this encounter at the gym with some like crazy internet boxing troll guy. And I told my wife the story and she's like, you need to make a video about that. And then I end up telling the story on a shaky cell phone video. And it's like my fifth video since I did the first vlog. And that ended up like going viral and like getting over 1 million views. And it was like a blessing and a curse. It wasn't something I wanted to be known for, you know, kind of I just felt it was too negative. You know, it was like, I don't want to put so much negativity out in the world, you know, talking about like what this guy's doing and making fun of him. I eventually realized he was maybe like a little mentally ill or something. And I was like, I don't want to be, I felt bad that it might be like mocking this mentally ill person, you know? So by that point I thought, you know, I'm going to do this. I had discovered like travel vlogging. And I was like, oh, that seems cool. That piqued my interest, but we didn't have any money to travel. So I was like, well, I'll just do like some hikes around LA. And you look at kind of the top videos that are performing in these same hikes that everyone does. And you're like, I'm never going to be able to compete with this guy who's already got all these views and all these subscribers. So I'm like, I don't know what the point of this channel is. I don't know what I'm doing. I just was at a major crossroads. And then around 2017, in a location that's maybe, what, 200 feet away from us.
Tell everyone where we are right now.
So right now we are in Zuma Canyon, near the fork where Newton Canyon comes into Zuma Canyon. And there's three waterfalls kind of in this immediate vicinity. Newton Canyon Falls, Lower Newton Canyon Falls, and Lower Zuma Falls. In 2017, I think it was around this time of year, maybe a little bit later, I decided to come for a hike and make a video. And it was right before sunset. And I ended up climbing down this Lower Newton Canyon Falls. I had never really rock climbed before or done any canyoneering or anything. And I was just like, oh, I think I can climb down that waterfall. It was kind of low flow, definitely lower than it is now. Real ledgy and juggy and more of a scramble than a climb. And I climbed down. I was like, you know, super pumped. I went further down the canyon. There's a bunch more cascades and stuff further down and just kept going. And then eventually I realized, oh, man, the sun just set. It's going to get dark really quickly. Luckily, I had a headlamp. I realized, oh, I got to climb back up that waterfall now to get back to the car in the dark. And it was just such a new, unique experience for me. I felt like such a badass by the time I got to the top. And I felt so alive and felt so energized that my life changed in a significant way in that moment. And I realized, like, this is the type of thing I want to do with my life. Whatever this is, this adventure, outdoor adventure, hiking, whatever it is, like, I want to spend my life doing this. And the acting is like, I'm not necessarily quitting or giving it up, but it's like, that doesn't define me anymore. I want this to define me. This feels real. Instead of going and playing a character and pretending to have an awesome life, I could do stuff like this.
And have an awesome life.
Yeah, I could do stuff like this and actually have an awesome life, you know? Instead of going and pretending to be like James Bond or Jason Bourne or whatever that is, I could actually go and do this and it's much more meaningful and real.
I want to hit your whole story thus far really quickly because there's a beautiful little thing here that I think is very valuable for people. So things that you are currently known for, having this popular YouTube channel where you are an adventurer who travels and goes outdoors and especially loves natural water slides. And thus far, you've told us that every one of those things came to you accidentally while you were on a totally different path. And I think that's really valuable because if you had not let yourself be open to something else, you may still not be that guy. You might still be that guy who's defining himself by acting and not realizing, oh, I can accidentally discover other things that also are important to me and maybe take a different path in life. And then also, I'm sure there are a lot of people who do follow your page who think you had a really targeted way of creating that and don't realize that this all kind of organically formed based on you just being open to new experiences.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that through the process, the more I try new things, the more I become open to new experiences. Like I just last summer started, I did my first multi-pitch climb in New Zealand. We did some top roping for the first time. A buddy I met through canyoneering, you know, was also a climber. And so he took us top roping and then we met him up in Vancouver last summer. And so did my first multi-pitch, did my first trad climbing. Yeah. So the more stuff I get exposed to, sea caves are kind of another passion of mine. And that was something else I accidentally discovered in SoCal, you know, first time I was in a sea cave was down in, I think it was Laguna Beach or something like that. Thousand Steps Beach. Through that process, discovered this thing called coasteering, which I had never heard of. And that's just another epic outdoor challenge that I love.
Which is not really a thing in the U.S. It's very much like a European. And did they also have it in New Zealand? Was it a thing down there?
I think it's starting. There's a couple places that are doing guided trips there now. We did a ton of it. We did a ton of like self-guided explorations, coastal explorations. And yeah, I love it. One of the things I love about it is like the minimal gear that you need. You know, it's like maybe a helmet, you know, and a wetsuit, and just like exploring the nooks and crannies of a rocky coastline and hucking these nice jumps into deep sea waters. We just did some last summer on Vancouver Island. And actually, unfortunately, my wife got injured. She's recovering from knee surgery now. I had to fireman's carry her half a mile back to the car. It was a great day up until that point.
And for anyone listening that still doesn't understand what coastering is, tell me if I've got this right. It's essentially hiking along coastlines. And typically people have done it before, so they know the best spots for leaping into the ocean. But it's hiking along the coast and repeatedly throwing yourself into the ocean, right?
It's not necessarily hiking. It's traversing, whether that's hiking, swimming, scrambling. Sometimes there's like deep water soloing involved. Shallow water soloing involved.
So it's navigating a coast by whatever means are necessary.
Through the intertidal zone, they say. Navigating coastline through the intertidal zone. And so a lot of the stuff we've done, there's not really any beta on it. It's kind of like a first-time exploration that we'll scout out on like the satellite imagery or something like that. And usually I'm looking for cliffs and caves or something that looks like it could be a cliff or a cave or an island or an arch or something. And then we just pick a spot on the map and we go for it. I've yet to do a guided coasteering trip. At this point, I'm not sure I would even enjoy it because I've done so much on my own. But there are a few professional guides I'm friends with online that I definitely would like to team up with them. We're trying to figure out, one guy I'm talking to in the UK, he's trying to figure out a good term for like a first descent of coasteering.
Oh, yeah, yeah. What would that be?
Yeah, so we haven't nailed it down yet. I proposed first coastent, but I don't think that flows off the tongue so easily.
Yeah, not particularly, especially maybe not in different languages either. So let's roll backwards a little bit. So we've run through this list where you've jumped from one coast of the U.S. to the other coast, down to the southern coast, then back to the other coast on the southern side, chased acting, and then along the way discovered that you do actually like traveling, even though you thought you didn't. And you climb up this waterfall and realize, hey, this was a super exciting adventure, and this is what I want my life to be. But simultaneously, you've also started this YouTube channel. So how does all of this start to converge?
I had filmed this adventure and then continued to seek out sort of adventure hikes. And so when I came across Chris Brennan's book, Adventure Hikes in the San Gabriels, that sort of opened up a whole new world. And so instead of doing the same old stuff that everyone does, this five popular waterfalls, I started seeking out these adventure hikes that were off trail, a lot of bushwhacking, some would call it class two canyoneering, scrambling. And especially during the drought, you know, finding these little hidden waterfall trickles, it was like a treasure hunt for me. And I became obsessed with the idea of hidden waterfalls. And I still didn't understand that canyoneering was something you could learn to do on your own. I thought, you know, you had to like go on a guided trip. I didn't really have a frame of reference for that, you know, until I don't even know how I came across it, but I came across Uber Adventure's webpage and I was like, oh, you could take classes in that stuff? Like, I had hiked Eaton one time and I had seen a group coming down, rappelling the falls. And I had just assumed it was like a guided trip. And then I somehow found you could take classes in this. I convinced my wife, hey, we should take a class in that. Because we had seen years ago the Seven Teacups and we had read, oh, they rappel that and stuff. And then we're like, is there a guiding company that does it? And then there was no guiding company. Like, do you rent gear? Like, we didn't know anything about it. Eventually, we ended up taking the level one course at Uber, and my wife wasn't totally into it at the time, the first time we did it. I actually didn't even get a chance to run my first canyon until like a year later. Normally, they do like after you take the class, they do Bailey Canyon as the first canyon after the class. So she was able to get that Monday off work and go run the canyon. And she was kind of like, eh, she wasn't super into it.
Yeah. And Bailey is like typically a very beginner friendly, almost always dry, though you missed last year when it was amazing, flowing, and even some Class C moments in it. But yeah, so typically like a beginner canyon, dry. It's a really good way to introduce people, but it might not inspire everyone.
And so because of that, I was kind of put off from it a little bit because she is like, obviously, my number one adventure partner. So if she's not into it, I'm not going to be able to force her. Eventually, though, I ended up doing more canyons, convincing her to do more, giving it another try. And I think the key to it for her, I think the key was like doing stuff that was a little bit wetter. She was working a lot. She had a weird schedule. It was like 7 days on, 7 days off. So there was moments where I had to, weekends where I had to find adventures without her. And so then that enabled me, like, okay, if she doesn't want a canyon, I can go do it with some other people. at a certain point, for several years, we had talked about maybe traveling again. We had been kind of working on this path of like maybe saving some money and traveling again. I was like, at one point, it was like, okay, a year from now, we'll do it. And then she said, well, let's do another 2 years or something like that. And I was like, well, if we're going to do another 2 years, I want to take more canyoning courses. I want to learn like the rescue technique and advanced techniques and stuff like that. So I worked my way through the levels. And eventually I was like, I might as well take this guide certification thing just to have it. And that way she can feel more confident when it's just the two of us going in a canyon. I know more techniques. And then like wherever we end up, like maybe we end up in Costa Rica or we end up somewhere and I could be a canyoneering guide or something like that. Those last couple years in LA, or the last year in LA really, I started doing more canyons. I seemed to alienate my audience that I had built up through the adventure hiking a little bit. They didn't seem really too much into the canyoneering. I think people get intimidated by the gear sometimes. It's weird because some people are obsessed with gear and that's all they want to do is anything that, you know, like the people on that climb Baldy, you know, they just want to use their ice axes and their crampons and they're obsessed with gear. And other people, they see the gear and they're real tentative and it puts them off from it. And so, you know, the views maybe from the canyoneering videos weren't that great, but I really loved it.
It's always so weird to me when canyoneering videos aren't popular because people love waterfalls. Half of Instagram is fucking waterfall pictures and waterfall videos.
Yeah.
And you would think people would really be like, oh, waterfalls, and you get to play in them, and they would love it.
Exactly. There's a broad misunderstanding of it, you know, all the time. Even when you read like news reports, they were climbing the waterfall. Right, it's like, right. No, they, because the harness and ropes, everyone thinks climbing. It's like, no, they weren't, you know, it's like, anyway, you asked where it all converges. So I'm not quite sure, like it all kind of converged. Like it wasn't all at one moment where it all converged.
Right.
You know,
just
it was like
time.
Different things happened at different times. The adventure hiking, like I'm so grateful to Chris Brennan. Like I've never met him, but I loved reading his adventures and like his exploits and just that sense of adventure and exploration that he had. Like some SoCal canyoneers like hate reading his beta.
This is true.
In the beginning, I wasn't even a canyoneer. I was just a hiker. And so like I was reading them more of a story and I love looking at the pictures of, you know, back in the day when they were doing all this exploration. It was so inspiring to me. I think that some people could learn from his sense of adventure. You know what I mean? Like instead of like viewing everything as has to be like a canyoneering route, like if you look at something as an adventure hike and maybe there's one or two rappels or just one rappel, like you don't have to poo-poo it.
The thing I always find funny are the people who want to brag about how quickly they did something car to car. And to me, I always find that very funny because it's like, so you had less fun? So you spent less time doing the thing you like to do and that was the goal?
Yeah. I will say I was trying to go faster yesterday when I ran Eaton. I was like trying to see how it's possible that Willie Hunt can do it in 4 hours, but
because he does it 12 times a week.
I did it in 5. I was happy with that time. I wasn't going exceedingly fast. I stopped and had a snack and a drink and I was impressed, but he must sprint up the approach. I cannot understand how he does it so fast. But yeah, I'm so indebted to like the people that came before, like Chris Brennan and like anyone who shares their adventures. Like I first learned of the Stoddard Canyon Falls, they call it, but Baldy Cut, whatever you want to call it, that slide over there. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I think I have seen video of it. I do not think I've been to it, but I believe I know the one you're talking
okay,
about.
Okay, so that was a slide. It rekindled my love affair with natural water slides because after the wedding, like that was the one and done. Like I hadn't done one since the wedding. And for years, we're doing the same old stuff here. And then, you know, I stumbled across a video of the Stoddard Canyon Falls slide and these kids sliding. I was like, wait, there's one of those here? You know, and this was after we had found Alder Creek slide in Sequoia. We had done that. And it was like, wait, there's one in our backyard, you know, and that sort of opened my eyes more to kind of the endless possibilities in the San Gabriels, you know. And so
I will mention this really quickly, speaking about waterfalls and jumps and things. I believe the way I first ever became aware of you is someone posted a video of you jumping the LSA pothole.
And they're like, this guy jumped from the wrong spot.
I don't remember if it said anything like that. I just remember at that point thinking, oh, I've never seen anyone jump this pothole.
Oh, really?
I don't think I would do it. And then, of course, last year, it totally made sense to do it, but the pothole was raging.
I was going to say, I've seen you jump it. I've seen a video of you jump it.
Oh, it might not be me that you saw.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if there's video. And I'm talking about from the rappel side.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've jumped it many times once you're down in it. From the opposite side
climbing
of the pothole.
Okay.
But from the almost blind jump from the rappel side, I had never seen anyone do that before, and I think you were the first person I saw do that.
Okay, cool. To be fair, it's probably a video of my friend Willie that you saw, but yeah, it might have been me as well. But I had the better angle of him from behind, and then I had my GoPro died like right before I jumped, so I lost my POV.
I think it was someone else's video of you. I think it was someone else who was in the canyon with you shot
video.
And
my arms are flailing, and like I didn't bring him into my side. But yeah. Yeah, no, that was a great day. LSA Class C is awesome. Good times. When you said how waterfalls are so popular and people love posting waterfalls on Instagram, it reminded me of my first and probably last like 100-foot plus cliff jump in New Zealand. After that, I had the thought of like, this is like not going anywhere good. Like I can't just keep like upping the
right.
And like I ended up tearing my pec on that jump, and I remember thinking after that, like, I just gotta get like abs so I can just stand in front of the waterfall and take a picture like these guys on Instagram, you know, and like I don't have to jump off of it, you know.
Yeah. I mean, 100-foot is pushing the death zone. You gotta really be careful.
It was gnarly. There was a lot of things that were pushing the death zone. It was a blind gap precision jump. So it was, no one has ever done that jump before, and no one probably ever should repeat it.
So where we were going earlier is the soldered slide kind of rekindled your love for water slides.
Right.
You are building out this YouTube channel. It's, I'm assuming, growing, though apparently canyoneering is not as popular as you're expecting it to be.
That's what it was, is that I had heard about like Water Slides Canyon. And that kind of hooked into the canyoneering thing and led to us pursuing canyoneering. Was there's natural water slides you can only get to by rappelling in. And that was, I think, the final kind of nail in the coffin, like, to convince my wife to take the course. Was like, there's all these water slides in these canyons that you can't get to unless you rappel into them. And so that was that missing link that I forgot to kind of link it all together.
I mean, also, when you go, say, for instance, like to Eaton, and you see somebody rappelling down that, most people don't realize there's more falls above. And often in those cases, the fall they see is not the most impressive one.
Right.
Kind of like Bonita Falls.
Right.
The fall everyone can see at Bonita is not the most impressive one. It's the large one before that.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So you really have to go in to really get the full experience.
Yeah. And so through that process of the adventure hiking leading to canyoneering and then wanting to travel again, in many ways, I was still kind of in a mentality of not appreciating where I was. Like, this is good, but over there looks better. Like, you know, these guys in Costa Rica and Switzerland, like, look at all the stuff they're doing. You know what I mean? So eventually my wife and I had saved up a bunch of money, and we were like, hey, let's travel again. And so in July 2019, we put our furniture in storage. We gave up our apartment, took off on a road trip up the West Coast, up to Canada. We road tripped for 2 months up to Canada, across the U.S., and then back down to Florida. We spent a couple weeks in Florida with her parents. We left our car there and took off to travel for what was supposed to be a year, and ended up being almost 3 years because, as you know, that was right before COVID.
Right before, like, July 2019. We're totally ignorant of what's ahead, just a few months away.
In October, we landed in Switzerland, met up with these guys I had been friends with online for a long time, the 42 Adventures crew, these crazy freestyle canyoners, they call themselves, and they knew a bunch of, like, slides, and it was kind of late in the season for them for canyoning in October, but we went on our first Via Ferrata with them, and so we were able to do some cool stuff. The little taste of Ticino, and then after that we went to Nepal. We did a 3-week trek in the eastern Himalayas to Kanchenjunga, and it was good, and it was a totally different experience this time compared to 2014, the first time we were in Nepal, because
you embraced this time that the travel was the purpose, right?
Exactly, because for so many months and years sitting in LA traffic, I would say to myself, you know, I wouldn't mind being on a Nepali bus right now. Like, an 8-hour Nepali bus ride, it's not as bad as sitting in LA traffic. And so once we got to this trek, like my bag, I was overweight. I was carrying like maybe 60 pounds. I ended up losing like 20 pounds on the trek. When things got going a little tough, I would just remind myself, like, you're exactly where you want to be. You said all those years you were in LA, stuck in traffic, you kept saying, I want to be in Nepal, I want to be in Nepal. You're in Nepal now. And so with every step, I'm sweating my ass off and it's hard and the bag is heavy and my shoulders are hurting. I'm just like, you're right where you want to be. You're right where you want to be. And it's what a totally different experience it was, you know? Going from a place previously of just like wanting to get to the next thing and being in a hurry and being in a rush to just being in such a place of gratitude and like trying to be in the present moment and enjoy where you're at, you know? And it was a great, great trek. January 2020, we're in Thailand and we're doing some cave exploring. No ropes or anything like that. We didn't bring any of our gear with us. We left that back in Florida because we were traveling for a year. We're just kind of out of a backpack. We didn't want to be lugging gear and stuff. We're doing some caves and there's a ton of bat guano and we're like, maybe we should get some masks so we don't have to breathe the bat guano in. And we're trying to get like N95 masks in these pharmacies in Thailand. And everyone we go to is sold out of N95 masks. And we're just starting to hear like the rumblings of like something going on in China. And then we're trying to get these masks and we're like, maybe this is like a serious thing, you know, like nobody has these masks, they're out of stock. And there's this thing going on in China. Like maybe this is serious. And my wife is like, well, let's go to New Zealand. Like it's an island in the middle of nowhere. So she's like, she had wanted to go there. It wasn't really on my radar. And I was like, okay, I mean, it's out in the middle of nowhere. Let's go there. And she's like, well, let's stop in Borneo on the way. So we ended up stopping in Borneo. You know, that was an amazing experience. Got to see orangutans and pygmy elephants in the wild and heartbreaking to see the infiltration of the palm oil plantations. But I feel truly grateful to see, you know, the wildlife, the threatened wildlife there. But yeah, just so sad to see how much the palm oil plantations have deforested Borneo. So we end up stopping in Malaysia for 2 or 3 weeks. And then we landed in New Zealand, end of February, 2020. And I think the day after we got there, they had their first case. But in Malaysia, they were like thermal scanning people as they got off the airplane. Like they were taking it seriously. A ton of people wearing masks. They were thermal scanning. We still didn't have any idea what was going on. We got to a layover in Australia and we were the only two people wearing masks. No one else was wearing a mask in the airport. And we're like, they don't know what's going on in Malaysia. Like, they don't know what's going on in Asia. It's a totally different response happening. And then the day after we landed in New Zealand, they had their first case. Our plan was to be there for 3 months. That's what the visa is for Americans, 3 months. So we decided to buy a van and build it out. And we're going to live in it for 3 months. Spent 10 days shopping for an old van and building it out. And then like maybe like 2 days after we were in the van and we were out, they locked the country down. They closed the borders.
It's so funny because all of this is happening and you're not aware. It kind of fell in a perfect place for you. Like you were in the right country to be in and you got there just in time.
We really lucked out in a lot of ways because they kept extending our visa. And so what originally turned into was supposed to be 3 months, turned into 26 months.
Which for people that aren't good at math, that's over 2 years.
By living in a van, we were able to stretch our initial 1 year travel budget. We were able to stretch that out, make it last so much longer. One of the ways to extend our visas, I think after the first year, was we signed up to be seasonal workers because they needed people to pick the fruit and stuff. And so we got the seasonal worker visa, which gave us another 6 months or whatever it was. And enabled us to work a little bit. So we worked for a month picking kiwis. After we did that, I was like, hey, we got some extra money now that we just picked kiwis for a month. we could buy some canyoneering gear. I had gotten the New Zealand canyoning guidebook like for a birthday present and was just drooling over the pictures in this book and just using it like we were hiking down the bailout trails to like just check out the waterfalls in the middle of the canyon and hiking to stuff that we could get to without gear just off the guidebook and just drooling over these pictures. Just like, oh man, I wish I had my gear. I wish I had my gear. And then after that first year and then we worked a little bit, I'm like, hey, look at this picture. Like, don't you want to like rappel this waterfall? Like, look at that blue water, you know? And so I was able to convince my wife, like, yeah, we could buy some gear. And then that opened up the door of like canyoneering in New Zealand, which was awesome. Before that, we had made friends with a girl from the States and she was there for an ICO Pro training to learn canyoneering. And so she and her boyfriend had extra gear that we did a few canyons with them, but nothing too high flow. But yeah, once we got our own gear, it was great. There was a period of time where we just did like a month of just amazing canyons, like over and over, you know, back to back.
So before we get away from it, I want to talk about logistics for a little bit. I know you said you had saved up some money, but of course this trip is going to extend longer than you expect. You take this job picking fruit. Prior to that, were you both just living off of the money you had put away? Or was there some sort of income happening while you were traveling?
So there's a little bit of income from YouTube. At a certain point, like before we left, my goal was like, I want to make this sustainable. The goal was like hopefully by the end of this year, I've built up my channel where I'm getting like a ton of views and I'm making, you know, a good amount to sustain the travel, to do the digital nomad thing. That was the goal. So there was, you know, a few $100 coming in from that, but it wasn't anything to write home about. It was certainly wasn't sustaining our travels, but it was a little bit of something coming in, but primarily coming off the savings. Occasionally I would like license videos out. There's these viral video companies that you don't necessarily have to go viral with your video to license it out. If it's just something that they think makes a good story or an interesting thing they can sell. So I had licensed several videos out as well. One of the videos I had licensed out from a hike in the Santa Susana Mountains from this flash flood in a cave, and it ended up on World's Deadliest Weather. And so I had like little drips and drabs of income coming in from that.
Yeah, some little unexpected income, it sounds like, also.
Yeah, exactly. And so that was always nice. The first like solid chunk of change other than savings was the picking kiwis.
Let's also talk about cost, because a big misconception is that traveling has to be highly expensive, which we know is not true. And I'm going to assume the way you and your wife chose to travel was not the expensive route. So let's talk about what the expenses looked like and like your approach to the travel so that it was doable for that extended period of time.
So she would be the better one to talk to about this.
But, is she your budgeter?
Yeah, exactly. She's the detail person. I'm the broad strokes guy, but I could definitely give you some broad strokes on that. We had kind of planned for $100 a day for both of us, not including flights. So once we got the van, that really took our costs down in terms of accommodation, because they have this kind of history of van life in New Zealand, and they have these freedom camp areas where if you get your van what they call certified self-contained, meaning you have meet these certain requirements for fresh water, gray water, stuff like that, you can stay in these campgrounds for free. If you're doing that, if you're camping and staying in a van and just cooking all your meals, you know, from the grocery store, it's pretty affordable. Although I will say, the first 6 weeks after they locked the country down, we stayed at an Airbnb on a 200-acre farm. And the reason for that was we were staying at a campground and they were like, we have to shut the campground down. We're going into lockdown. And so apparently there are some people that did lockdown in New Zealand in their van. We didn't know that that was an option. So we were just like, we have to scramble and find something affordable for that first 6 weeks. In terms of traveling cheaply, it really has to do with the country that you choose. But even in Switzerland, we found like a $50 Airbnb and like 8 bread and chocolate. And, you know, like we did it super cheap, you know. Switzerland is notorious for being one of the most expensive countries in the world, you know. So we did like, you know, adventures on our own. Like the Via Ferrata was free. We borrowed a harness and, you know, the natural water slide, the canyons we did, the stuff was free. We borrowed whatever gear. I think we rented a wetsuit. It all, I guess, has to do with your expectations, your, you know, how comfortable do you need to be? You know, some people, I say like luxury is an illusion, is what I tell people. Comfort is an illusion. If you look in the wild, like animals who find a real comfortable place to go and bed down and like hide, like that's usually like right before they die or something, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I'm terrified of being too comfortable, because then you stop moving and stop doing things and then you degrade and die.
Plus, I feel like luxury travel is kind of all the same. Like, you know, all-inclusive resorts and that kind of thing, cookie-cutter experiences, like anywhere you go in the world, it's kind of all the same experience.
What I say is it is having an American experience in another country.
Yeah.
And that's what they do. Like, can we take your American lifestyle to another country,
right,
so you can have that experience in another country instead of experiencing that actual country?
It makes total sense. That's a good way to put it. And so, like, there's super cheap ways to travel. I mean, if you go to the store and buy peanut butter and a loaf of bread, I mean, that can feed you for a week, you know, for $5 or whatever it is. So it's like, when you do it, you find, you know, it's not as expensive as, you know, unless you want to buy canyoneering gear. And then you're like, oh.
Right. Then you blow the budget.
Right. And you're like, oh, I need a 7mm semi-dry wetsuit.
All right. So back to the, I guess, more fun stuff. So you've bought the canyoneering gear. You're hitting up the canyons. But yeah, this 3-month trip is now going to turn into a 2-year and 2-month trip.
Yeah.
So what does the rest of that look like? And then what makes you decide to come back or leave or whatever happens next? I mean, obviously, you've also got COVID lockdowns, right? So you kind of are not allowed to leave? Or would they possibly have thrown you out and forced you to go back to the
U.S.? So there was a lot of, right when the lockdown happened, they were doing these repatriation flights. And we actually ran into a couple of people from California. And they're like, oh, the State Department says we have to come home. And I'm like, I don't care what the State Department says. I'm not going back.
They're not
going
to come get you.
Yeah. But they're like, oh, we're leaving tomorrow because the State Department, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, oh, good luck. You know, we're staying here. But the 6 weeks lockdown in New Zealand... Man, it's so funny. I have a funny anecdote about that, actually, because there was like kind of 2 levels to the lockdown. One was like you're only allowed to go to the grocery store. And then so we were kind of stuck in this Airbnb, and then they lowered it a level. And so you could travel to your housing. It was some weird loophole. And we're like, OK, let's find another spot to go to. So we found another Airbnb, and it was like in Queenstown. And so it was closer to the mountains and the hikes and stuff like that. We were allowed to do like a hike, but it had to be within like a 30-minute drive away or something like that. And it couldn't be an overnight, and you couldn't do anything risky that could cause you to need a rescue. When we got to that second Airbnb, we were like watching New Zealand version of MTV or something. They were playing like these old 80s, 90s videos. And this, it's embarrassing and funny, but deeply profound. Like this old Wilson Phillips video came on, which is
man,
like
half of the audience has no idea who you're talking
okay,
about.
Okay, right? So like they were like this all-female pop group in the 90s, right? One of their hits came on. I had never seen the video for it. I think the sound was even turned off, but I immediately saw, I was like, they filmed that in the San Gabriel Mountains. I was like, I recognized the trees, the mountains. I was like, that's the San Gabriels. And it was like literally in that moment when I saw that, after being in lockdown for like a month and not doing hardly anything, like literally my eyes began to like well up. So we've been traveling for like 7 months at that point, and I felt this incredible like homesickness. And it was like, I saw the San Gabriel Mountains and I was like, I literally was brought to tears.
By Wilson Phillips.
By Wilson Phillips. It's such a hilarious story, but it's true. And it's so embarrassing, but it's a true story. It was seeing the mountains, and it was, I hadn't realized until that moment what a profound connection I had to these mountains. Because so many, I don't want to keep using the word pivotal, but so many important, intense experiences happened for me in these mountains, that, and I hadn't realized it. I hadn't realized how much it had changed me. We hadn't really been able to explore much in New Zealand yet, and it was kind of like, I didn't realize what waited for me, you know, on the other side of lockdown, you know? And in that moment, it was like, oh, I just wish I was home, and I wish I was in those mountains, you know what I mean? Because I really didn't know anything about the canyons in New Zealand. I really didn't know anything about, she had done all the research, she had wanted to go there. I wanted to experience more culturally diverse places and not kind of a westernized, anglicized place like New Zealand. I wanted more of the Asian feel, you know what I mean? More India, more Laos, Cambodia, something more exotic, you know? And the thing about New Zealand, the people are great, they're super friendly, but it's like, you know, there's dominoes and it's westernized. I was a little disappointed with that at first until it was like, oh, they have tremendous world-class natural beauty. I'm not like a huge Lord of the Rings fan. Apparently, a lot of Lord of the Rings fans go to New Zealand.
Were you not aware of this?
Honestly, I wasn't. I mean, I knew they filmed them there, but I didn't know like people would go there just because of Lord of the Rings.
I feel like even people who didn't know what Lord of the Rings was and didn't care about Lord of the Rings for that, what, 6 years or whatever those were being released and that was occurring. It was such a huge cultural phenomena. I can't
totally
believe
oblivious.
It.
Totally oblivious. It was like, oh yeah, this is where they filmed Lord of the Rings. It wasn't like, I didn't realize it was like, oh, this is filming location tours and all this stuff.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Like, I didn't realize it was like,
yeah,
big
you
business.
You could go to Hobbiton, man.
Exactly. We didn't. I didn't go.
Wow. People just turned this podcast off just
I'm
now.
Sorry. I'm sorry, Lord of the Rings fans. I love you. I love you. But, you know, New Zealand for me is so much more than Lord of the Rings. I got to experience it in a way that most New Zealanders have not experienced it. Those 26 months, we traveled, we hit so many, tons of coasteering missions, tons of canyoneering, tons of hikes. We did several of the Great Walks. I think we did five. So they have 10 hikes that are kind of like their preeminent hikes that a lot of international travelers will do. They're called the Great Walks, and they offer some of the most stunning scenery in the world. We were able to do five of those. But even some of the hikes that we did that are not Great Walks, just as beautiful. Glaciers, glacial lakes, tremendous mountains, like everything. It's so beautiful. The beaches on the North Island, the beaches up there, we spent like 2 months up in the beaches in the subtropical North Island, snorkeling, and just amazing times. And I hate to say it. It's painful for me to say this because it just shows me how far I still have to go. We had a tiny van. I'm 6'2". I'm a big guy. When we were buying the van, my wife was like, it's a little small. How do you feel about it? It's like, well, it's only 3 months. We're only going to be in it 3 months, right? Fast forward 26 months, you know, it's like, I'm sick of living in a van. I want to go somewhere else. I want to go to Sri Lanka. I want to go to India. I want something more. You know, I was back kind of in that place of like, this isn't good enough anymore. I want something new. Looking back on it, of course, with 2020 vision, you know, it's easy to see. I blew a tremendous opportunity. We could have been on a fast track for residency because they offered that to people who were there during COVID. They were like a once in a lifetime, hey, if you were here during COVID, we'll give you this path towards residency, which would have saved us a bunch of like hoops to jump through. I kind of blew it. My wife was like, hey, you want to try to get residency here? And it's like, no, I want to, you know, go back to LA and like start a guide company and like do.
Dude, why are you always fucking up her dreams, man?
I know, man. I can't believe she stays with me. If I had known we were coming back here to live in Florida, 100%, I would have stayed in New Zealand. Like, I honestly would have stayed, man. I thought I was coming back to live in LA. But, you know, it is what it. So we got back to Florida and her parents are getting older. Her dad just turned 80. He is growing palm trees. They have a bunch of acres and they're getting older and they needed help. And we realized how much help they needed. And we're like, shoot, like, I don't think we can go back to LA. Like, it seems like they need us here. And that's why I am a part-time palm tree farmer now. For the time being, stuck in Florida, helping out some family members that need it, you know?
Pretty sure you're going to look back on this fondly later, too.
I probably will.
Yeah.
I don't know. Florida kind of sucks.
Come on. My mom moved to Florida. It was her dream place to live our entire childhood. So some people love it there.
Some people do love it there. I mean, the springs are beautiful. I've been able to explore the springs a bit, trying to get a taste of some free diving in now and stuff, which is cool. But man, I miss the mountains, which is why I ran Eaton 2 days in a row.
Yeah, I mean, that's the tricky thing about much of the South in general, is so much of it is so flat.
Luckily, Tennessee and North Carolina.
Yeah, not too far from you.
So that's kind of been a little bit of an escape. Get up there a couple times a year, and that's been nice to do that. But for me, like, honestly, when I smell the bay laurel, this makes me, like, emotional. Like, it makes me feel like when I saw that Wilson Phillips video. I swear to God, like, just smelling this in Eaton, like, I started getting misty-eyed. It smells like home. I don't know. It's just good to be back in SoCal. Like, I feel like I have to make the pilgrimage at least once a year because it's such an important place for me. I don't know. I don't know how to communicate, like, how vitally important it was, the experiences I've had in these mountains and canyons here, you know?
How long have you been back now? You've been back 2 years, 3 years?
We got back May 2022.
Okay, so almost two years.
Yeah.
But it's not like you're just chilling in Florida, just being a palm tree farmer.
No, I mean, we've been able to go on some trips. Not as many as I would like, but... Oh, so here's something that happened once we got back to Florida. We went to Colorado, and then I was going to go to India by myself for 5 weeks 2 summers ago. So this was the summer of 2022. I took off, flew to India, was going to be there for 5 weeks, had an amazing 5-week itinerary planned, and a hurricane hit my house.
In India or
no,
in Florida?
In Florida.
Okay.
And I lost communication with my wife and family, I had no idea what was going on. And I was in India for 41 hours and then got back on a plane and flew back to Florida to find that the bridge that connects our barrier island to the mainland had been washed out, and had to figure out logistics of how to get a boat out there with supplies and everything. And it was just a total mess. 2 months of tree cleanup, and luckily, structurally, the houses were okay. No big damage, but a ton of people, their houses got wiped out and everything. And all the time, I'm like, we're just sitting here waiting to get hit by another one. Like, what are we doing here? Let's get the hell out of here. But it's not my call right now. So yeah, I was in India for 41 hours. A year later, a year and a half later, I was able to get back to India recently, actually, for a couple weeks. Was able to find some adventure in the Western Ghat Mountains and do some cool things, some cultural exploration, some new foods and stuff like that. So yeah, I've still been able to do a bit of traveling. Obviously, not to the extent that we were at before. We were up in Vancouver Island and Vancouver for a month, and that was great. My wife blew out her knee. She's recovering from knee surgery now, so that's kind of limiting our travel as well. But hopefully, once she fully recovers, the goal is to kind of get away every couple months, every 3 months.
So India has come up numerous times, and it sounds like you've been there multiple times. What's the draw specifically for you with India?
There's several things, but I think the most important one is that my mantra has been to embrace things that scare you. And it's easy for me to say that to people who are like, they see me going through a cave and they say, I'm claustrophobic, I couldn't do that. And I say, you know, fear is an illusion, it can be overcome, that kind of thing. Or they see me jumping off a cliff and, you know, fear can be overcome and stuff like that. But I had a legit panic attack the first time we were at the Taj Mahal, just from the amount of people that were there. Just overcome by fear and panic, and a complete panic attack, and couldn't appreciate the Taj Mahal. And so for me, going back to India, the primary thing was to confront that fear head on. And I felt like I was in a much different place to be able to do that. You know, I was prepared for the intense culture shock. I was prepared for the wave of people and chaos and horns and traffic and bombardment of smells and all sorts of new experiences. And so for me, the primary driver was to kind of make good on that first experience and say, you know what, I'm not going to let that define my kind of relationship with this country or my relationship with travel from here on out. So that was the primary thing. The secondary thing is it's just such an interesting place. There's such a diverse, you know, there's so many different religious aspects, cultural aspects, architecture, and natural beauty. I mean, you've got the Himalayas, you've got the Rajasthani desert, you've got the Western Ghats, the jungles, tigers, elephants. It's just such a unique, diverse place. I love Indian food. I waited tables in an Indian restaurant in college. It was my first taste of Indian food. I've got hooked. It's my favorite food. All those things combined for it to be kind of the perfect storm of places that I want to keep going back to. There's so much to explore there, you know?
So you got to go there recently. You're in Florida for the time being as a palm tree farmer, which I suppose we could talk about that a little bit as well. What exactly is involved in being a palm tree farmer?
Picking up limbs, picking up palm limbs that get blown down in the wind, and occasionally fertilizing, a lot of like repairing irrigation lines.
Are these going to be shipped across the country, or is this
landscaping?
Okay, so it's a landscaping, local landscaping.
Yeah, landscapers buy them wholesale, and so they are responsible for digging them up. They have the machinery to dig them up. We just grow them. I'm kind of doing a better job of embracing that as well. It's kind of the bane of my existence. But out there during the summer, doing anything in Florida outside in the summer is brutal.
Yeah, anything in the South in the summer, yeah. In 5 years, are you going to have a palm tree empire? And we're going to be recording a new podcast where you're talking about how you weren't open to it at the time, but then you realized that you truly loved it on the inside?
I hope not.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about the future, because you run this YouTube channel that's all about adventures. We also need to talk about the name of the YouTube channel and where that comes from. So obviously you're continuing to run this channel. You're continuing to try to travel. You're simultaneously, you know, handling important family business. So what do you foresee? And as we know, whatever you foresee happening usually changes based on circumstances. What do you foresee for yourself for the next few years? What are the things you're working towards or the goals you've set?
The one thing right now is my wife has mentioned Patagonia. So I think South America in some form is on the horizon. Personally, there's a lot of opportunity for first descents in India, particularly the northeast of India. There's not a lot of people running canyons out there. I would love to do some first descents in India. Getting back to New Zealand, even just for a couple weeks to run some more canyons out there would be definitely at the top of mind. But other than that, I would like to certainly make it over to the UK to do some co-steering. I've toyed with the idea of possibly trying to shoot a co-steering documentary. I've got the rough kind of outline of what that might look like. I haven't really fleshed it out yet, but I think that could be interesting. Nothing really concrete yet. A lot of it has to do with my wife's knee recovery. More of just taking it as it comes. I still get the occasional audition here and there down in Florida. Some acting stuff might pop up here and there. It's not really steady or anything like that, but it's every once in a while.
All right, so what's the name of your YouTube channel?
Well, my YouTube channel is just my name, Jesse St. Louis.
But you were referred to as the infamous Jesse St. Louis. Where does that come from?
That comes from a friend of mine, one of my oldest friends, known him since elementary school. You know, I was kind of notorious for, I guess some people would refer to me as a discipline problem in high school or middle school. You know, I was always top of my class academically, but perhaps maybe a discipline problem. Maybe get into fights. And I was certainly an angry young man. But I also did kind of dumb stuff, you know, kind of built a reputation of being the crazy guy. And so often he would introduce me to new people or his friends or something as the infamous JSL. When I was plugging in my social media, it was, I'll just make that my username or whatever, you know, because that, he had introduced me as that so often, you know.
So you embraced it.
I embraced it, yeah. And that's often I tell people, you know, I've tried to twist the meaning a little bit to embrace, you know, yes, I have done some bad things. Maybe I'm infamous. Maybe my reputation precedes me. But, you know, it's not necessarily a bad thing.
All right. So now I want to talk about two other things that come from your YouTube presence, your online presence. Do you like for people to call you the I word?
The I word?
Influencer.
Oh, influencer. Oh, no. I hate that word. No, please don't. I can't even influence my followers to buy a t-shirt. So I would not call myself an influencer at all. The only thing I would hope is that I know I already do this, is influence people to live life to the fullest. I mean, that's the most important thing for me. At the end of my videos, I often say, get out there, find your adventure, and be infamous. By that, I mean live life to the fullest. You know, find your adventure, get off the trail, get poison oak on your junk, you know, if you have to, which I did on this very trail. And just embrace the bumps and bruises. Something I often say, too, as a joke, is it's not an adventure till I'm bleeding. You know, don't be afraid of getting dirty, muddy, a little bit banged up, maybe some bruises or scratches. You know, I also say, you know, skin grows back. You know, if you get a skinned knee or you're a little bit bloody, it's all good. It's all part of the fun. That's an adventure kiss, you know? And so if I influence anybody, it would be to do new things, new experiences, get out of your comfort zone. And I know for a fact, based on a lot of feedback I get, that I achieve that.
So this is the point where I probably should cut it off, because you just gave us this great ending statement. But I'm going to ask you one other thing before we do that. And hopefully you're not freezing. Because you can get your
jacket. I am
jacket
a little shivery.
You,
yeah, no,
you need
I'm all right.
A jacket. All right. But we will be wrapping up shortly. People have a lot of misconceptions about people who make YouTube videos. What are those things that you would like your audience to know about you, other than what they probably assume about you?
I'm not an expert in anything. And I think people think that I'm an expert, but I'm just a regular guy. You know, I grew up boogie boarding and playing basketball during the summer, was a fat pothead in college. And
infamous.
And didn't come to this lifestyle until very late in life, my late 30s. Didn't jump off my first cliff or ride my first natural water slide till 32 or something. You know, didn't run my first canyon until I was 40. And so I would say it's just like, don't be intimidated by, if you see me doing something that looks like that's way crazy, just realize I started at the same place you're probably starting at. All you need to do is just go one step further than you're at now.
So you've just given two great inspirational statements based on my last two questions. And despite that, I'm still going to ask you the final question of the show. Do you know the final question of the show?
It's been a while.
All right. What is the final thought you want to leave the audience with before you go?
Man, it's so hard to top the last two things I said. Now it's time for me to sound like a dumbass. I think my final thought would just be, get out there, find your adventure, and be infamous.
All right. I'm not going to make you say anything else after that. Thanks for making me hike through the creeks and go see these waterfalls and get our shoes wet and sit here so that you can freeze your ass off. People listening don't know, we tried to make this happen earlier, and nature has tried to stop us from recording this, but now we finally made it happen. Thank you for meeting me here to do it, and let's hike out of here.
Awesome. Thank you.
And now it's the part of the show where I invite you all to go to our website, gogetoutside.com. Look for this episode 118 with Jesse St. Louis. And there you will find photographs of Jesse in action, links to everything we talked about in today's show, lots of links, including links to a number of his videos, and most importantly, a link to that Wilson Phillips music video shot in the San Gabriel Mountains. And if you should want to contact us here at the show because you have opinions about this episode, past episodes, future episodes, or you just want to make me feel special, you can do that a number of ways. You can send an email, jason@gogetoutside.com, or you can send a text or leave a voice message at 818-925-0106. And if you would like to do me a great big favor, please go to your podcast purveyor of choice, make sure you are subscribed to the show, rate and review it, but most importantly, share it with someone who you think would enjoy it. And one last thing, while you're there on the internet, how about going to our YouTube channel, or you can look in the show notes for this episode and find a link there. I did recently release a 12-minute video about a 6-day backpacking trip through the Sierra Nevada last summer. So if you want to get a look at the Sierra Nevadas when they are covered in snow after a very wet winter, then you should go click on that link and take a look. Next time on the show... Come back May 16th for Sheryl's Jocelyn of the Canyons Are Calling podcast. Get yourself ready for the crossover event of the century as our two podcasts meet. And we discuss canyoneering, guiding, and the realities of producing an ongoing podcast. May 16th, Sheryl's Jocelyn. See you then.